I approach my topic as an intellectual historian. And so what I am really asking in my lecture is, what's going on with conservatism today? There's a sense of great turbulence and dispute and so forth. And I say one way to examine what's happening and to understand it is to look at the intellectual history of American conservatism since 1945, because in many ways I see Trumpism as a challenge to the kind of conservative consensus that emerged in the era of Reagan. So what I do as a historian is to understand various components of conservatism as a coalition. So fundamentally, conservatism in America has never spoken with a single voice. It's been a coalition. And five elements have developed since 1945, five distinct components, if you will, in intellectual terms. The first is what are usually called libertarians or classical liberals, free marketeers, who were concerned and have been concerned about the rise of the welfare state, entitlement spending, and so on, and who desire to have a less regulated capitalism as a pathway to prosperity, are worried about too much state interference in the economy. The second group, represented by a Michigan figure of note, Russell Kirk, the late Russell Kirk of Macosta, Michigan, a distinguished man of letters, writer, historian. He wrote a book back in 1953 called The Conservative Mind, which did as much as anything to give the label conservative to the phenomenon that we're talking about today. He represented a group of more traditionalist conservatives, as they were called, who were concerned that the traditional institutions and moral values of American society and Western civilization were under strain, and that modern liberalism in some ways was operating as an acid that was weakening these foundations. So they wanted to turn away from modern liberalism in various ways. The third component was the cold warriors of the famous Cold War against the Soviet Union from the mid-40s until the early 1990s. And these people were on the right as well, and who favored a very assertive posture toward containing and defeating communism in the Cold War period. And many of them were ex-communists themselves. And so anti-communism provided a third component and a very vital glue to keeping the whole coalition together. And fourthly, the so-called neoconservatives arose in the late 60s and into the 80s. Former people on the left, the soft left, liberals, social democrats, and so on, who had became disillusioned in various ways and gravitated toward conservative positions. And finally, what was called 20 or 30 years ago the religious right, now we tend to say social conservatives. So those five groupings came together partly under the leadership of William F. Buckley Jr., noted figure in his day, founder at the age of 30 of National Review magazine in 1955, had the firing line show for 30 years on public television. And then following Buckley, and they overlapped, Ronald Reagan. And Buckley and Reagan were both great ecumenical leaders who managed to keep these tribes, these coalitional elements together, because there were distinct differences of emphasis within them, disagreement on some issues. The coalition had, you know, some sound and fury at times as they worked out their internal debates and platforms and the like. What I argue is that in the 1990s, the Cold War ended, and that put great strains on this five-part coalition of conservatives, people who had that label, who were united in particular by their hostility to the socialist, tyrannical communist left, Stalinism, and so on, but also united in opposition to what they saw as the weaknesses or failings of modern liberalism, or as we might say, progressivism today. Well, with the end of the Cold War came a loss of that impulse to stay unified. You have a common enemy, the Soviet Union, the evil empire, as Ronald Reagan famously called it. And so, beginning in the 1990s, there has been a self-conscious search by elements on the intellectual right to create a kind of new source of unity for a new era. And so all sorts of formulations have been propounded and get a certain amount of advocacy, but nothing seems to quite keep everything together. So they no longer have the common enemy to bind them. Also, during that same period, they had a period of great prosperity. More magazines, more think tanks. The Acton Institute in Grand Rapids would be an example of a conservative or libertarian kind of think tank that would be thought of as part of this larger constellation. But prosperity brings with it certain perils, and that is there's a tendency to feel self-sufficient and go off and do your thing in your little niche and not have the same sense of belonging to a larger community of discourse or a larger movement. So both what I call the perils of prosperity and the decline of communism created tendencies for the movement to fracture. And also comes the internet and social media and the possibility that anybody can have a website. And so increasingly there is a sense that the movement does not have a general staff, doesn't have gatekeepers anymore. And why? Because on the internet there are no gates. So when Buckley was running National Review, his famous and still influential magazine, it was about almost the only conservative magazine in existence. Now you can go online and you have thousands of options for reading conservative thinkers of one kind or another in little subdivisions, and sometimes they jostle with one another, and they're the neoconservatives and now the paleoconservatives who don't like the neoconservatives and think they're too interventionist in the Middle East and so on. So you have these subdivisions and battles among conservatives. So basically, the Buckley-Reagan era lasted. Reagan's presidency ended in 89. The Cold War, you could say, ended in about 1992 with the formal collapse of the Soviet Union. And then there's been this period, which included the post 9/11 period and a kind of rallying and national unity rallying in the wake of Islamist terrorism, 9/11 and so forth. But nothing has quite replaced that older sense of camaraderie, unless it is something that comes from the left that becomes perceived as another threat. Well, by the time we got to the Tea Party movement in 2009 and 10, is a kind of reaction at the grassroots of conservatism to what is perceived as a lurch to the left on the part of the Obama administration, a lurch exemplified by the Affordable Care Act and by some of the great spending programs to pull people out of the Great Recession. And this caused a massive groundswell of opposition. But that Tea Party revolt, which I think is a kind of Reaganite libertarian populism, don't tread on me, too much government spending, so on. It was a kind of revival of Reaganite thinking, but it quickly morphed into something different. Its enemy became not just the enemy on the left, so to speak, the Obama overreach as they saw it, but also the establishment of the Republican Party. And so the Tea Party people felt the Republican leadership in Washington was not effectively handling Obama's initiatives and was craven or just incompetent, inept, whatever, and they became increasingly frustrated. And then there were massive Republican victories, Tea Party-type victories in 2010, 2014. Suddenly they had the Congress, Obama's still in the White House, and they don't see that anything in particular is being done. And then increasingly immigration was roiling the conservative waters, and they sensed that many of the Republicans in Washington, like John McCain, the late John McCain, for example, were really not on the same wavelength with them when it came to how to deal with immigration. So I argue in the lectures that I give, including the one here at Grand Valley State University, that the Tea Party's frustration created the tinder for the next phase, which was the advent of Trump, because it was Tea Party disillusionment with the Republican establishment that created an opening for Trump to come in and say, as he said in his acceptance address, he says, things need fixing, and I'm the only one that can fix it. That's a close paraphrase of what he said. So he came in as Mr. Fix-It. I'm the guy who knows, and I'm the guy who sympathizes with those feeling left behind. And so Trumpism then is not Reaganism, really. It is in some ways a rebellion against the kind of conservative consensus of the Buckley-Reagan era, including the Bush era thereafter. So Trump, in my view, is a hybrid. It's a hybrid of both conservative populism and left-wing populism. It goes after three establishments simultaneously. The Republican establishment, Trump did, obviously, his competitors running for president and so on. And he was an outsider with no great record of consistent support of Republican causes and philosophy. So he was suspect and he was an outsider. Secondly, he goes after the conservative intellectual establishment, most of which initially opposes him. And thirdly, he goes after the Obama liberal Hillary Clinton establishment. So Trumpism is a remarkable phenomenon in that it's a hybrid, and also it's attacking three establishments simultaneously. Now, I better interject here a word about populism. I define populism very simply as the revolt of quote-unquote ordinary people against overbearing elites that are considered to be insensitive and uncaring and condescending. By that simple definition, there have been left-wing elites in the United States that go after big money, Wall Street, corporate America, the millionaires and billionaires, as Bernie Sanders called them. There's a left-wing populism which has considerable root in American history, going back to William Jennings Bryan and in the 1890s and some figures in the Great Depression, Bernie Sanders. And then you have a kind of right-wing populism, more recent, after World War II. Think of McCarthyism and think of Reagan in his own way, who don't go after big money or big corporations. They go after big government. One goes after the private sector elites as hurting the common people, the left-wing variant. The right-wing Reaganite variant, if you will, goes after big government elites that are regulating us to death and so forth and don't care about the ordinary people. I see Trumpism as a mixture because if you look closely, at least as Trump as he campaigned, he not only wanted to make America great again, build up the military, certain things you might say would resonate with a Reaganite person, but he also talked about infrastructure spending in a big way. He made it clear he did not want to go after Social Security or Medicare or entitlement spending. And in that regard, he was in many ways like these European movements, populist movements that are occurring as we speak, in that they can be rather welfare statist and nationalist at the same time. So Trumpism is sort of nationalist populism, but that can have different targets and a mixture of results. I tie in Trump to the paleo-conservative offshoot of the conservative movement that developed in the 80s. The paleos were sort of traditionalist conservatives and some certain kinds of libertarians who went after the neoconservatives for being liberals in disguise, Wilsonian interventionists abroad. They're getting us into wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and so on, and invading the world, and also at home rather so-so on issues of deregulation and free market economics. If you compare Trump to what the paleos were saying, and the paleoconservative leader in the 90s, and he's still around, is Patrick Buchanan. What do the paleocons want? They say, therefore, America first. They don't like third world immigration. They don't like globalist free trade, and they don't like globalist political interventionism. All of those themes are present in Trump. And I would say there's an uncanny resemblance between what Trump was campaigning on in 2016 and this paleoconservative phenomenon, which was on the scene, especially in the 90s when Buchanan ran for president twice, along with Ross Perot, this eccentric Texas billionaire, who also was a Mr. Fix-It. I know how to fix it and so forth. And so you can find antecedents to Trump that way. Now, I don't know whether Trump is aware of all of these or how much it's a deliberate calculation. I rather doubt it. But he stumbled on in his America First talk and talk about the need for tariffs and looking out for the forgotten Americans. He stumbled onto themes that had been adumbrated by Patrick Buchanan and the paleoconservatives. So Trumpism, as I would say it in short, is in some ways has been a systematic challenge to Reaganism. In first, Reagan was an internationalist. There was a Cold War going on. It was an international phenomenon. But now Trump is skeptical of NATO, skeptical of alliances abroad. Looks like our allies are not treating us fairly in trade policy and in commitment to the common defense. So Trump sounds like Buchanan. He sounds a little bit like American conservatism before the Cold War. And then he attacks free market economics, talks about tariffs, at least as a weapon to try to get better deals, trade deals. So he goes against the conservative orthodoxy, again associated with Reagan and that era. And then there's supply-side economics, kind of the orthodoxy of the Republican Party and of the Wall Street Journal editorial page, and Trump was deviant on some of those matters as well. So through this framework that I've just given you, what I'm seeing in Trumpism, to the extent that it's an ism, and Trump isn't always a Trumpist in every moment of the day. What this phenomenon does, Trumpism does, is to challenge the intellectual underpinnings of the Paul Ryan and other types of people of the late Reagan era. And of course, a lot of those people were horrified and opposed him or were very tepid and have tried to tame him and so forth. So through the intellectual framework, which is the subject of my lecture here at Grand Valley, I try to analyze how Trumpism arrives as a kind of revolt against that in the name of people who have been passed by. And he was very strategic and very perceptive in identifying elements that would respond, as we know, in Michigan and other key states, to his appeal. One further thing about Trumpism, what I see happening, and particularly in the first year of his administration, was it like these two tectonic plates clashing. The lingering paradigm of the Cold War Reagan free trade movement and the Trumpian nationalist populism, America for Americans, America first, don't push us around, and moving away from the American exceptionalism rhetoric that Reagan was so eloquent at stating. So Trump comes along and he has a different mindset, which in a way is a more Hobbesian. The world is a rough place, and the way you get somewhere is by being tough and making people, respond. And so he's more unilateralist than Reagan tended to be. So all of these things, I think, help explain, just beyond voting statistics and so on, what in a larger sense has been happening to conservatism and its imperfect vehicle, the Republican Party.
George Nash, you are a political historian and author. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.